Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 30th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing yesterday's death penalty case, Glossop v. Gross. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome back to Teleform return guest Kent S. Schadiger. He is the Legal Director and General Counsel at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation in California. He's also a member of the Federal Society's Leadership Committee, the Executive Committee of the Criminal Law Practice Group. We're very pleased to have him here today. With that, Mr. Schadiger, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Yesterday, the Supreme Court returned once again to the question of methods of executing the death penalty. As a little bit of background, there has been an evolution of these methods from hanging in the early part of the century, or the Republic, to the gas chamber and the electric chair, which were adopted as supposedly less painful than hanging. And then lethal injection came in fairly recently in our history, and mostly in the 1980s and so around that era. And that, again, was thought to be a better, more humane, less painful method of executing the death penalty. Some states adopted it for that reason, and some adopted it simply to get rid of the litigation that was coming in, trying to stop executions based on the gas chamber or the electric chair methods. The method adopted in every state initially was a three-drug method pioneered in Oklahoma, where the first drug was a sedative, sodium thiopental, and then the second drug was a paralytic, and the third drug was potassium chloride, a simple chemical which stopped the heart and actually caused the death. That went along fine for a number of years until the mid-2000s, when it came under attack on the theory that if the first sedative drug was not properly administered, the second and third drugs would be extremely painful. That went to the U.S. Supreme Court in the case called Bays versus Reese, which was decided in 2008, but which had no majority opinion. The plurality opinion accepted the defendants, that is the challengers, view that a method of execution could be attacked with reference to available alternatives. And the alternative, they said, was to simply use a single massive dose of barbiturate to both anesthetize and cause death, which is in fact the way animals are put to sleep by veterinarians every day. So the standard set forth by the plurality was that the method being attacked had a substantial risk of serious pain, and secondly, that that risk could be significantly reduced by the alternative being proposed. They found that the petitioners in that case had not met that standard, and the three-drug method was upheld. That went along okay for a couple more years, but then there was a cutoff of the drug being used as the sedative, first sodium thiopental and then pentobarbital. The problem was that the drug market had become internationalized. These drugs were either made in Europe or under the control of European countries, and those companies, under pressure from European governments, had cut off the supply to the State Departments of Corrections. As a result, states went looking for other drugs, and the states of Florida and Oklahoma adopted a method where they would use the same three-drug method that was at issue in Bays, but they would substitute a drug called midazolam for the first sedative drug. So the defendants, the plaintiffs in the civil case, attacked this protocol, saying midazolam was not up to the job. And they had their experts saying that it's not an approved drug for use in major surgery where there's going to be otherwise extreme pain. It does not put the defendant into a coma-like state, as the drug at issue in Bays did. And it would not necessarily keep him unconscious. The odd thing about the expert testimony for the challengers was that they never directly addressed the key issue as stated in Bays. That is, they never said that the executed inmate was sure or very likely to be in extreme pain under this procedure. And curiously, neither of the opinions in Glossop brought out that variation between the testimony and the standard. So the majority opinion had a couple things to resolve. The first one was whether they should treat the standard in the plurality opinion in Bayes as the definitive and authoritative standard to be applied in this case. All of the lower courts to consider this issue up until this case had considered the plurality opinion from Bayes to be controlling. The plurality set out the standard that it set, and Justices Thomas and Scalia had opined that it was even more generous to the state than that. So under the Supreme Court's usual method of applying its plurality opinions, I think the Bayes plurality was the definitive controlling standard, and that is what the majority said. Justice Sotomayor challenged that in the dissent, but that's not really her strongest point. So then they go on to the risk of available alternatives step of the analysis, and they found that the defendants had not come up with an alternative that was available to the state. The challengers said that sodium thiopental would be better, pentobarbital would be better, but these alternatives were not actually available given the boycott by the manufacturers. By imposing the alternative requirement, that effectively knocked out the challenge, and that is the most important holding of this case. It's going to make it very, very difficult for anybody challenging a method of execution, and it's going to make it especially difficult and perhaps impossible for anybody whose real purpose is to stop the execution altogether and not simply to avoid pain in execution. And I think in almost all cases, that is the real purpose. The court went on to uphold as an alternative ground a finding by the district court that the challengers had not demonstrated that the use of midazolam presented a substantial risk of extreme pain. That holding, I think, is less precedential. It's basically upholding a district court factual finding saying it's not clearly erroneous. It doesn't say that another district court judge might not find the other way. Lurking in the background is an issue that came up during oral argument. What should the judiciary do when there is a guerrilla war, to use the term used in oral argument, going on to try and stop the execution of the death penalty? If it is the law, if these are judgments of courts that should be carried out, should we facilitate a strategy to prevent our judicial system from carrying out its judgments by such things as manipulating the supply? And I think that's the real implication here. I think that strategy is going to be much more difficult for those trying to carry it out, and I think it's much more likely that court judgments will be executed once they have been fully reviewed through our very extended review process. Well, that's essentially the case. There is another kind of side battle going on. Justice Breyer wrote a very long opinion rehashing all the arguments against the death penalty. And Justice Scalia had a sharp response to that opinion, but that isn't actually the question before the court. So with that, we'll go back and open it up to questions. Dean?
Thank you very much. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might be ringing in today, let me talk about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we will have another Courthouse Steps teleforum discussing the Texas housing case that was decided late last week by the court. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. On Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we will visit with Senator Mike Lee. That's 11 o'clock Thursday. He'll be talking to us about American exceptionalism as the Federalist Society embarks on a new month-long project. So tune in for that Thursday at 11. Next week, we will have a wrap-up of the criminal cases in the court on Monday. On Tuesday, we'll have Charles Murray talking about his new book and much, much more that following week, next week. Today, of course, we're talking to Kent Scheidegger about the Glossop case, the death penalty case. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have just one question at this point, so let's go to that question.
Thanks, Dean. This is Stephen Duffield here in Washington. Question for you, Kent. You were really helpful when the Senate was trying to work on some habeas reform efforts. I guess it was almost a decade ago at this point, because it was 2005 or so. And I was just curious if you see any role for Congress. You've kind of looked past the Obama administration, but are there still areas there where you think that Congress should get involved to try to improve the system? Or is it too late for all that?
No, it's definitely not too late for all that. One issue that's directly related to the issue before the court in this case has to do with the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. For many years, the FDA took the position that enforcement of the drug restrictions against lethal injection drugs was not its job, because that wasn't the purpose of the FDC Act, or the drug portion of that act. Its purpose was to provide safe and effective drugs for medical treatment, and lethal injection really had nothing to do with it. And the Supreme Court said in 1985 in Heckler versus Cheney, that's right, the FDA has that discretion, they can do that. Then a couple of years ago, the D.C. Circuit came out with an opinion saying that as far as importation of drugs goes, it's a different rule, and the FDA doesn't have that discretion. And if any drug hasn't met all the requirements to be imported to the United States for use as medicine, the states can't import it for use as lethal injection either. I think that decision is wrong. I think Congress could very easily abrogate it with a very simple statute saying basically the understanding back from Heckler versus Cheney was correct, and it applies to both domestic and foreign sources. This isn't the purpose of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. This is a completely different use of these substances. And the regulatory scheme of that act really has no application.
Thank you.
There are
Once again,
possibilities we can talk about, but I'll wait. I'll let some other people ask questions first.
Okay. The lines are wide open now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. While we're waiting, Kent, let me ask you a question. You mentioned the Justice Breyer opinion, which is sort of a wholesale or a broad attack on the death penalty itself. I haven't read any of the opinions in this case, so I plead ignorance. I've only seen what I've seen in the press. But I understand that that was joined by only just by one other justice only. Mm-hmm. Was that a surprise to you? Is that correct, first of all, I guess? And is that a surprise? And is it the case that the remaining justices are agreeing that the death penalty is not inherently unconstitutional?
That is correct. It was not a surprise to me. I think Justice Breyer has been making some noises along similar lines for a while. And we've had one or two justices taking that position off and on since 1972, so I don't see it as a big problem. I mean, we had the big cataclysmic clash in 1976, and the Supreme Court decided that the death penalty would be constitutional, but would be subject to these additional restrictions. And to undo that would be a massive overruling of precedent. And I don't see that position getting a majority anytime soon. But you never know. I mean, the next president will probably nominate successors for several justices, and we could see a dramatic change. So given the present makeup of the court, I don't see that as a big issue, but it's subject to change.
Okay. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We are getting a few questions now, so let's continue on with the audience.
Hi, I live in Washington State, and I know that Washington and Oregon have assisted suicide laws, and it's interesting. I don't know if this came up in the case, but a lot of death penalty opponents are also assisted suicide proponents. And they claim that the methods that they use is kind and gentle. And where it comes to drug availability and so on, I'm wondering if the court in any way made a point or brought up this interesting conundrum, you know, that drugs seem to be available for assisted suicide, and yet enforcement of the death penalty is cruel and unusual. I'll let you go.
In states that have assisted suicide laws, of course, the medication is prescribed by a doctor and they are able to get it. And yes, it is a barbiturate, which is the method that was used beginning in Ohio in 2009, a single massive dose of barbiturate that is used in states that have assisted suicide for human beings, and it's used everywhere for animals. And yes, almost everyone who's ever had a pet put to sleep knows that they do just indeed go to sleep and then die from there. It's not hard to do it if you have the appropriate drug.
But in the context of this case, was that discussed in any of the briefs or oral argument or any of
the... Well, it came into this case in that was the alternative method that everyone agrees would be better, but is not available to the state because of the manufacturer cutoff.
Okay.
But it's available for assisted suicide.
Yes, it is.
Alrighty then.
Huh?
Interesting. Once again, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. Let's take another call now.
Hi. My question is more of a right-left political one rather than so much a legal one, but when we talk about corporations choosing not to service certain people or certain industries based on moral views, you know, the classic argument of the florist who doesn't want to take care of the gay wedding or what have you, why do we never hear the same objection with how can drug corporations have these moral views about how their drugs get used? I never hear that argument get made on the left, you know, which seems to me pretty much a parallel argument, you know, like corporations can't have moral views on, you know, whether or not to service a gay wedding. Well, then how can they have moral views on whether or not their drugs get used to service an execution?
It wouldn't. You're right. I don't hear very much about that. I mean, I've made some noise, not so much about corporations that don't want to sell drugs to the corrections departments, but my problem more is those companies that put resale restrictions in their contracts, thus imposing their own views or views they have been pressured to adopt on people further down the supply line. It seems to me that if a person has or a corporation has lawfully purchased a item, it should be free to sell it to whoever it legally can sell it to, and that this imposition from higher up on the supply chain is problematic. So it's considerably going further than a corporation not wanting to sell directly. It's a much more... Its tentacles reach longer than that.
Great. Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are going to be wide open. Let's take another call.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Kennedy. I'm from Columbus, Georgia. My question kind of piggybacks on the last one with the market manipulation. I did not read the opinion yet, but did the justices leave any room at all for there to be, other than a congressional change, some other type of methodology argument in the future other than the pain and suffering argument? Thank you.
Leave room for an argument other than the pain and suffering argument. I mean, the issue before the court is the claim that the method being used is cruel because it risks causing pain. So, you know, that's the issue that they were discussing. Are you talking about, I'm not quite sure what the question is.
I'm sorry. with the market manipulation, if this market manipulation continued with the response of the Supreme Court today, would there be some other argument other than the pain argument that could be put forward since this was a narrow ruling? Or are we back to just the morality argument?
Well, there are other arguments that are made, you know, against the death penalty generally and against particular judgments in particular cases. And all those other arguments are still open.
Thank you.
Those arguments are open, and so are our lines. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at this point. Let me ask a question about, everybody's interested in the effects of a Supreme Court opinion, whether it's going to forestall other claims or not. I know that on next term, there's already at least one death penalty case, Hearst versus Florida. I don't know if you're up to speed on it or not, but I understand it questions whether the Florida's death sentencing scheme violates the Sixth or the Eighth Amendment.
Yeah.
Does this case have an impact on that at all? Or?
Yeah, not directly. Florida, way back in the 70s, when the existing laws were thrown out and all the states had to adopt new laws with no guidance from the Supreme Court as to what would be accepted, Florida adopted a system where the jury makes an advisory verdict, a recommendation, and then the judge is the final sentencer. But in reality, unless the jury recommends death, it's almost impossible for the judge to impose death. But a question arises because of the Apprendi issue. Does the jury have to render a verdict of the aggravating circumstance that makes the case eligible to be considered for the death penalty at all? Is that like a higher degree of offense such that the it must be found by a jury and must be beyond a reasonable doubt and so forth? This is a case where we have a state whose death penalty system was considered and reviewed and approved by the Supreme Court almost 40 years ago. And now there's this new argument that it's somehow become unconstitutional. And it's like we just keep going over and over the same systems and the same issues, like nothing's ever settled. So it's kind of disturbing that can even be raised this late in the game. If we don't have any calls pending, I'll go back to the first call, which mentioned the legislation that went through Congress in 2006. Congress did enhance its habeas corpus reform in 2006, and one of the reforms was to have the U.S. Department of Justice make an initial determination as to whether states qualified for a fast track through federal habeas corpus, which a decade earlier than that, Congress had offered to states that provide adequately funded counsel in the state review of the case. And that reform has been stalled for another decade by litigation. It's in a court which, in my opinion, has no jurisdiction to be hearing it. And so one other tweak that Congress could offer is to simply confirm what it said in the initial legislation, and make very clear that review of that determination will be solely in the D.C. Circuit and has no business being decided out in Oakland, California, which is where it is now. I think the attackers have basically gone judge shopping and picked the one judge in the country they think is most friendly to their viewpoint, and that's something that Congress thought it had precluded when it passed the 2006 legislation.
About the attackers, the death penalty opponents, I see a lot of death penalty cases at various levels in the judiciary. Are they almost all being brought by one group of death penalty opponents, or how organized is the death penalty opponent community?
No, I wouldn't say there's one group. There are organizations that are explicitly anti-death penalty. There are a lot of academics who kind of specialize in the field, all of whom are hardcore opponents. And if you read Justice Breyer's opinion and look at the citations, it's pretty much a roster of the hardcore academic opponents of the death penalty. Strangely enough, because of a drafting error that Congress made, federal public defenders on federal dollars are going back into state court and representing death row inmates in state court, something that was never intended by the statute. A lot of big-name law firms are doing capital defense, which they think is pro bono publico. I think it's contra bono publico, but really doing kind of scorched earth litigation, just attacking the death penalty and trying to stop its implementation. So there is a very broad opposition and well-funded. It's got money from people like George Soros and so forth. So it is quite an array of forces on either side.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have some time left. About the law firms that are involved in this, how do they get a death penalty case? Does one of the organizations approach them? Or I can't imagine somebody on death row finding a law firm. Or is it their lower...
sometimes they volunteer for appointments, and sometimes I think the public defenders or somebody involved in the case recruits them. I don't have a lot of detailed information about that because they don't talk to me very much.
Is there a next predicted line of attack or sort of angle that some cases working their way up through the system are uniformly taking in terms of a line of attack on the death penalty?
We do have the case in California, which claims that simply the delay in the execution itself creates a constitutional issue. That's an issue that we call the Lackey claim after Lackey versus Texas many years ago. Every once in a while, that sort of claim will get one or maybe two votes on the U.S. Supreme Court, but never more than that. And it's a very strange claim because it is basically the opponents who have created the delay, and then they claim the delay as a method of making further attacks. And that irony is regularly noticed. Anytime someone brings it up in the Supreme Court, usually Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas will write a concurring opinion pointing out that contradiction.
I've seen those opinions before, and I guess I've seen the rebuttal to those opinions, which argues that in this particular case, say the accused is Smith, the delay wasn't necessarily of Smith's making, and it wasn't necessarily a result of Smith's case in particular, but it's the result of our criminal justice system as it evolved, perhaps maybe very much at the hands of death penalty opponents, but you can't charge Smith in this case.
Yeah.
As being responsible for that delay.
That is part of the debate, and certainly the Supreme Court itself has a heavy responsibility for the amount of delay that occurs, because it has done so much tinkering, to use Justice Blackmun's word, that it has created a very complex body of law. Justice Scalia's response for that is, well, let's just overrule all the tinkering cases, which is an interesting idea, but not terribly likely to happen.
Let me make a final call for questions here. We still have quite a few people on the line, and we have time left for questions. Push the star button, then the pound button, if you have a question, like ask our expert, Kent Schadiger. I don't see any. Oh, here's one more question. Let's take a moment and hear from another caller now.
Hi, yes. I was wondering if you might be able to explain on that very issue as far as the delay tactic that's been employed. I noticed a rather impassioned concurrence. I believe it was in a recent habeas case. It was just decided within the last week. I'm actually looking for the exact site right now. From the latest round of opinions that came out, but he was highlighting that exact issue. And it was actually kind of surprising to me because I thought, especially in light of what was still pending on the court's docket here with Glossop, that he would have been so vocal about it. And Justice Thomas actually gave a pretty effective rejoinder to it. And I was curious what your impression would be on the tack that he took in that regard, if he was trying to be solicitous of more, more of an application that would fit that exact construct, because perhaps the votes are there to take issue with that.
I'm not sure exactly. There's been a lot happening in the last week, so I don't have all the recent opinions right at my fingertips here. So I'm not sure exactly which opinion you're referring to. But I don't think the votes are there to take this up, although depending on what happens in the California court case, we have a case on that issue presently before the Ninth Circuit, and it'll be argued later on in the summer. So if a lower court actually goes the other way, then certainly I'm nearly certain the Supreme Court would take it up at that point. So they've never gotten anywhere close to the four votes to take it up in the Supreme Court from lower court decisions rejecting the challenge. But if one actually accepts it, then there's a good chance it will come to the Supreme Court.
Okay. I just found it. It's Ayala v. Davis. Or excuse me, Davis v. Ayala. It's Alex.
Oh, yeah.
Ninth Circuit.
Well, Justice Kennedy wrote a concurrence in that case, not so much about the delay itself, but the fact that Ayala had been in solitary confinement for a very long time. Is that the one you're referring to?
So he's focusing more then on the solitary nature of the confinement versus the length of time.
Yeah, the conditions. His opinion is more on the conditions of confinement than the delay itself.
But given that seems to be a hallmark of death row inmates in many of the states, do you think that could be a collateral attack that could materialize there if, you know, he knows behind the scenes, so to speak, that there is enough of an inclination to move in that direction among his brethren?
I don't think that Justice Kennedy would be joining use of that to actually set aside the death sentence. I think it would be more in the nature of a civil prison conditions case to move them to different or somewhat better conditions. Now, the actual underlying issue there has to do with San Quentin. San Quentin has a little maximum security facility. San Quentin is not a maximum security prison, but it does have a facility within it, which is sort of maximum security. And it has that for a very good reason. It has that because there are a number of prisoners who, given that they have nothing to lose, will kill a prison guard given the slightest chance to do so. And I don't think Justice Kennedy sufficiently appreciated the extreme difficulty faced by the prison officials managing that kind of population. So I've wandered off the question a little bit. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
But I think he would be looking more for a remedy, a civil injunction to improve the conditions, than he would for actually using that to overturn the sentences. That's just my read of him.
Well, that's certainly heartening to hear. I appreciate it. Thanks.
All right.
Let me make another final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Seeing none, let me revert to you, Kent, give you a chance to wrap up or express a final thought if you have one.
Well, I noticed you talked earlier about American exceptionalism, and I think this is a case of where the lingering in the background of the case, the court is very concerned about this guerrilla war on the death penalty and about the interference with our ability to decide our own issue and manage our own affairs. And I think they really took a big swipe out of the ability of others and outsiders to interfere with that. I think that's an important step forward for justice. I was very pleased with the decision, and I hope next term we'll see more good decisions.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate your appearing on Teleform once again. To our audience, thank you as well for calling in. A reminder about our Texas housing case tomorrow at 3 p.m. and a schedule of other upcoming calls that's available on our website. But until our next Teleform call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.